How do parents display a message about excellence? What are the messages that we give? So let's consider some of the examples that we give our kids, and what are some of the consistent messages that we give and that we don't give. Does your child, does your four-year-old, thank God my wife Susan and I have a seven-year-old girl, Eliana, and one of the examples that we try to give her is about benching, that we bench together every single time. So after a meal, do our children see us benching, or do we ask them to bench, and then do we finish it off in about 30 seconds? What's the consistent message that we give? Each one of us has a different message. Do we talk to our children about being good kids, about being good citizens? And I want to give very simple examples, and then they watch us go through a red light. Do we tell our kids not to lie, and then we tell them when the telemarketer calls up, or someone from the yeshiva dinner calls up, we tell our 13-year-old child, tell them I'm not home. Do we tell our kids to be good citizens, and then they overhear us talking about our friends and neighbors that might be stealing money from somebody? So what are the messages that we give to our kids? What's the consistent message that we talk about? What do we say, and what do we do? And this is not lecturing parents here this evening. This is asking a question about what do we say to our kids and what do we show our kids. Okay, so let's talk about why we're here this evening. Let's talk about drugs. In the 60s, the drug of choice was acid. In the 70s, marijuana, ludes, quaaludes. For those of us that were in New York at the time and going to college at the time, we knew that ludes came from Canada. They were imported from Canada. This is not to pick on Canada. In the 70s, amphetamines, depressants, pills of every single color, red and blue and green, any type of color pill that you wanted, did you have to stay up late because you had a lot of tests that you needed to take and you needed uppers, or did you need some downers? What did you need? And you can go to any university, any college, and get virtually everything that you wanted. And the fact that you can buy for $2, as Mr. Hayward said, was exactly the story. In the 80s, crack cocaine was the epidemic, was the rage. Heroin. We're not talking yet in the firm community. In the greater community, people were using all these drugs. There were some individuals within the Orthodox community that were using it, but it hadn't yet penetrated to a very large extent. But drugs were always available. And then there were the 90s, the famous E. How many people in this room know what E is, by a show of hands? How many people don't know what an E is? Can I pick on somebody? Okay. Ecstasy. Ecstasy, commonly referred to as E. What is ecstasy? What is E? What's E? Anybody but J and Marla. What's E? A rave drug. What does it look like? It's white. What does it cost? What does it cost if you're a girl? It's free. Why is it free if you're a girl? I'm on tape. I'm not going to go very far with this. Okay. And we have a 13-year-old in the crowd. And I'm very happy that some folks brought their children this evening, because that's a very important point we're going to be discussing. So what's old? Drugs were always there. What's new? What's new is in the 90s, a number of people from Israel to Russia to Belgium decided that it wasn't good enough, that some people over there could make all the money. And so a number of individuals in Zivamenshin, in our community, became some of the world's largest drug dealers. particularly plying ecstasy. And you've heard some of the stories, and I don't know if any such situation occurred in Toronto, but it occurred with regularity in New York City, where a number of 17 to 25-year-old young men, boys and girls, newly married couple, would be taking a suitcase with a false bottom from New York, from Paris, to Belgium, back and forth, with 5,000-10,000 pills of ecstasy. On behalf of, these would be firm people, on behalf of a Jewish drug dealer, to dispense it within our community, to our kids, to go to parties. That's what was new. That's what was new. What was also new, that when my father-in-law, Oliver Shalom, used to make a kiddush on Shavuos, Yahrzeit, for his parents, who died in Auschwitz, my father-in-law would put out 3 bottles of Shivas, and he would have the most expensive bottles of booze in his shtiebel. 3 bottles of Shivas would be the most expensive bottles of booze. Today, when you're making a kiddush on Shabbos for $600 for the food, you're also putting out $600 bottle of booze, because you're putting out that single malt for $125, and you're putting out a couple of them. That's new. Those are two issues that are very new, and it has a very significant impact. Just one story. We all have lots of stories. When you ask a 13-year-old, how did you start? What's the most common answer? How did you start? Why did you start? What's the most common answer? What's the single most common answer? There's a lot of quizzes here tonight. Friends. Friends, friends, friends. This is a great crowd. Okay. Where do 13-year-olds learn how to drink? In shul. What? At home, in shul, at a shalom zoch on a Friday night, Shabbos morning. About 2 years ago, I was sitting in shul, and I was speaking with a 30-year-old, a young man that I know from the neighborhood. There's a kiddush club in shul. The Rav hasn't been able to stop it. And a man in his 50s comes up right before Musaf starts. And he was gone. And he comes and he sits next to his 30-year-old son, and he lays his head on his son's shoulders. And at that instant, his son caught my eye. And I was deeply embarrassed for this 30-year-old. He just didn't know what to do with himself. You know, on the one hand, Kibud Av is a tremendous mitzvah. On the other hand, you just want to climb into the ground, because you just don't know what to do with yourself. So we admonish our kids not to drink, and all the while we provide easy access. I'm coming into a city that I don't know too many people, and you folks are my hosts, and I had a very nice day, and I'm going back tomorrow to New York, and I probably won't see many of you for a long time, and I hope I do, but I want to make one point, since I don't know who I'm offending, about kiddush clubs. There's one rav in my community. I live in the 5 towns in Long Island, who had tremendous courage. He has a very large shul with hundreds and hundreds of people, and one day he decided it was enough, and he stopped the kiddush club cold turkey. And he has gone through tremendous pain from his Baal HaBatim. Some of the people left. They said, you know, how do you do this? And you know who is most supportive of him? The wives. The wives are the most supportive when there's no Kiddush club in shul. I don't need to finish the sentence. I think most individuals here understand where this is going. So how do I know? What are the signs? What are the signs if my child is using drugs? A number of times we've done seminars like this, and we've done it together with adolescents. This evening we had a couple of young people in there, late 20s, 30s, early 40s, speaking. We've done these seminars with 16-year-olds speaking with their parents, some behind the curtain for anonymity, because it's a small, closed community. And I remember one evening on stage, I meet with the 16-year-old and 15-year-old, 14-year-old, and the parents beforehand. We go through some sort of a dress rehearsal, so it won't be totally shocking. I also like to know what they're going to be speaking about. The whole thing is not rehearsed at all. Spontaneity is very important. And on stage, in front of hundreds of people, the 16-year-old is talking about how he's using drugs. He is now in a much better situation. I think he was 18 at the time. He was talking about 16. And he's talking, and his mother was sitting next to him. And they're behind the screen. So I see them in the audience. The audience doesn't see the woman and her son. Very prominent people. Exceptionally wealthy people. The whole community throughout New York and probably outside of New York knows these names, knows this family name. The 16-year-old is talking, and then he talks about how he's bringing drugs into the house and how he was smoking in the house and how he and his friends were partying in the house, and his mother was sitting there with her mouth open. And I'm telling the audience, you don't see what's going on behind the screen, but his mom is totally shocked and she's got no clue. And then we go and talk about it. She knew that her son was using drugs. She had no clue that there were ever drugs in her house. She had no clue. She didn't smell. She didn't know the smell. She had no idea what she was looking for. I guess it was done when she wasn't home. Parents are the last to know. I'm in Lakewood recently, speaking with a principal about a situation that he has in the yeshiva. Nothing to do with drugs. I'm leaving with a colleague, Phyllis Mayer, and the principal comes out, asks me if I can take a moment with one of his staff. And she says, "Mr. Mandel, can you introduce my son to an undertaker?" I said, "Excuse me?" She said, "My son has recently started using drugs. I'd like you to take my son to a morgue. I'd like you to take my son to see what it's like." When we talk to a 19-year-old girl and we asked her how she started at age of 14, she said that her older sister introduced her to drugs. When we talk to a 17-year-old boy that was an alcoholic, how did you start? He started when he was 13. He started in shul because alcohol was so accessible. So there are many entry points. I'm sorry. When your child has a change in behavior, when your child becomes moody, depressed, when he's secretive, when he has a change in grades, when he has a change in habits and language and clothing, when he begins to steal, these are not necessarily all signs of drug use. But each one of them are certainly in combination are signs of a question that you should be asking about drug use. Let's talk about fences. This is the most important point I wanted to talk about this evening. How do we talk to our kids? When do we talk to our kids? Do we talk to our kids when they're 12 or 15? There are four ways. There's a direct way to talk. There's the oblique way to talk. There's a time to talk when you find out there's something going on. Or there's the no way I'm talking about this issue at all. We have good friends. From when the time their daughter was 3 and 4 years old, they talked about everything. They talked about body parts. They answered virtually every single one of her questions. There was no such thing as, "Mamala, we'll talk about that another time. That's not something I want to talk about." My wife and I happen to think that our friends were insane. You know, we just didn't think that you talk like that to a 3, 4, 5, and 6-year-old. But that's one way of speaking very directly that parents choose how to speak about. So maybe we can take a lesson from the Chafetz Chaim, okay? One of the greatest sages of all time. What did the Chafetz Chaim do? What did the Chafetz Chaim do with his children? What did he speak about? This is in Rabbi Wolbe's book. The Chafetz Chaim spoke with his sons one time when each reached the age of 15 and explained to them the details of physical maturity, appropriate conduct. Once in his lifetime, every young boy needs to be presented with all the halachas that apply to this area of his life. Tremendous tests await our youth. What an awesome responsibility parents and teachers have to inoculate the children before they face these challenges. Now, the Chafetz Chaim spoke to each one of his sons when they reached the age of 15 about physical maturity. My father, Rav Shalom, spoke to me about these issues on the morning of my wedding day. And I said to him, Abba, I'm okay. I was so embarrassed for my father, Rav Shalom, but each parent does it at a different stage. If the Chafetz Chaim does it at 15, there's got to be something right about that. So there are two views about speaking to children. One view is that you bring this information into the house. And the other view is, under no circumstances you bring it into the house. One view is, let's discuss with our kids drugs, alcohol, you name the topic. Tatala, who's 12, Mamala, who's 11, 14, 8, pick an age, pick the issue, we're going to talk about it. Let's sit down, what's going on, what do you know? Let me tell you what I know. The other way, Rav Shmuel Dishon, the principal of Yeshiva Kollel Stollen in Brooklyn, has the opposing view. Under no circumstances do you talk about this issue in a Jewish home, any Jewish home, about these issues. Because the issue is not clean, the issue is tameh, and even discussing it in a home creates a problem. So there is no right or wrong answer. So how do you approach it? The suggestion that I'd like to make this evening is that parents need to discuss amongst themselves what they want to do. Father and mother sit down and say, we have a 6-year-old, we have a 10-year-old, we have a 15-year-old. What do we want to talk about? Do we want to talk about this issue? Something happened in town. There was a killing, there was a death, unfortunately, a couple of months ago of somebody in town. It was drug-related. Do we want to bring it into our house? Our kids are going to hear about it anyway. They read about it in the newspaper. They'll find about it from school, from friends. Do we want to talk about it? So father and mother talk about it and make a decision. What happens if father and mother disagree? How do we deal with it? So, our sages tell us that mom is always right. Our sages tell us, no less than the Ramban, in his letter, one of the most famous lines we know, Shema b'ni Musa avicha v'altitash Torah simecha. Heed, my son, the discipline of your father, and do not forsake the guidance of your mother. And the Ramban says that the guidance of your mother refers to fences and safeguards in every generation. Fences and safeguards. So when parents speak together about how they should approach and what they should talk about, and they're not sure, the Ramban says, defer to the wife. The Ramban also says, don't just capitulate. Don't just say, honey, you know what? Whatever you want to do, go ahead. Don't worry about it. That's not a father's responsibility. That's abdicating responsibility. So one of the important discussion points for this evening is how do we talk to our children? A good way, I think, to talk to our children is in a very indirect way. It's very hard to have these conversations direct. Because our 14-year-old son or daughter is going to say, I'm okay. You know what? We don't need to talk about this. So good way is to speak in a very indirect way. You know, there was a newspaper article that came out about drugs. Do you know anything about it? The New York Times recently talked about how Canada is liberalizing their drug laws. Did you happen to see that article. What do you know about it? Canada has one of the more liberal laws on marijuana. I don't know if I'm quoting correctly. It's still on the books, but it's something that's being spoken about. Without going too far into the issue of gay marriages, in that same article about Canada liberalizing marijuana laws, it talked about how Toronto in particular, how many New Yorkers are coming over to Toronto for civil unions. So if we have an issue in our home, and this is the point that Rabbi Dishon was making, in which our view of society is changing, and issues that our kids are learning in yeshivot and day schools are being challenged in society at large, how are we addressing it to them? How are we discussing it? Talking about it head on is not going to work. So we need to talk about it in an indirect way. A good way to mention it is, you know, I heard about Stewie. I heard that Stewie had a problem last week with some drugs. So my 13-year-old son, David, you know, what did you hear about it? What did you hear about it? You know, it's good to say, how do you think we should support him? How do you think we should help the family? It's very terrible to say, son, you're not doing that, are you? I know you're not a boy like Stewie. That's not how we want to talk. How do we as a community inculcate our children? In Japan in the 70s, there was virtually no drug problem. There was an absolute zero problem of drugs in Japan, an entire country at the time of 70 million people, because society as a whole did not tolerate it. Visiting Toronto a number of times over the past few decades, Toronto had a worldwide reputation, has a worldwide reputation as an exceptionally clean city. And I remember visiting a number of years ago and asking, how do you keep a city so clean? I come from New York. It's a little bit different. And the answer was very simple. Because when anyone sees a child dropping something on the street, an adult will tell them, pick it up. Society, the Toronto society did not tolerate dirt on the street, did not tolerate graffiti. I hope that's still the case today. So a community can instill a code of conduct on tolerable behavior. I know in a family, we always emulated, my wife and I, when we were in our early 20s, we had friends who hosted the Fusniks. Whenever anyone came from Russia, they always stood in Pinky and Bertie's house. And it's something that we said to ourselves, we always want to do that when we start a family. We'd like to have an open house. Chanoch Teller, the Israeli writer, talks about bringing singles into your house, inviting them for Shabbosim so they feel warm in the community. What my wife and I used to do, is we would be a home in the community that an adolescent would know that he can come for a Shabbos meal. If parents were in a certain situation with a 14-year-old or a 17-year-old, they knew that that young man, a boy or a girl, could come to our house for Shabbos. No questions asked. And we would just spend some time talking about them in a very, very relaxed way. The reason that we used to do that is because my wife and I had to build some fences within our house. At the time when we were doing it, we had an infant. And as our daughter became 3, 4, 5 years old, some of these kids just didn't know boundaries. And some of the words that they were using and some of the things that they were talking about, my wife began getting very nervous that our 3-year-old and our 4-year-old would absorb that. And I'm a professional. I deal with this all the time. And I'm not saying this because I'm a wonderful husband. I didn't see it. I just didn't see it. Because to me, it was a natural environment, these conversations. And my wife said, this just isn't something that should occur with a 3, 4, 5-year-old in the house. So we had to build some fences within our house. And we can't do that anymore. But you know, 2-3 weeks ago, I saw a young man that was in my house quite a few years ago. He said, you remember me? And I said, no. And he told me his name. And I said, I still don't remember him. Well, I'm the guy that was in your house a couple of years ago with a ponytail. And I wasn't exactly sober when I walked into your house. And I'm getting married in 2 weeks. And just look at me. Don't I look wonderful? And it was just great. Not that my wife and I had any credit to do with it, but just the fact that he walked through our house for that one Shabbos meal was just terrific that we see him now. Who are our kids' friends? Parents can't choose the friends for their kids, but you can help shape the friends. You might be able to invite your friends' friends over for an afternoon. You might want to invite your friends' friends on one of the trips, going to a baseball game. But don't become your friend's friend. Don't become your son's friend's friend. He's not your friend. He's your son's friend. So how do we shape our children's behavior with their friends? If we know that friends are the single greatest influence on introducing drugs and alcohol, how do we shape it? That's a conversation that a husband and wife would want to have when their son is 7, 8, 10, 12 years old. If there's any one thing that my wife and I worry about the most as a 7-year-old with our 7-year-old daughter, it's this conversation. It's remarkable. I wouldn't have thought that my wife and I would talk about my daughter's friends when she was 5 years old. You just wouldn't think that you would have such a conversation. And finally, let's talk about prevention. If they say, we never know who they are, but if they say that time is the best healer, spending time with your kids is the best way to develop relationship with your kids, how do we spend time? So once again, let's look at some of the people that, in my humble opinion, are much smarter than I am. But Shmuel Kamenetsky, Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Philadelphia, talks about dinner. Dinner, what Shmuel talks about, is the most important time to spend with kids. Rav Pesach Kron talks about baseball. Rav Kron talks about taking your kid to a baseball game and spending time with your son or your daughter in a game. Fun, no pressure. Rav Yisrael Weizman talks about private time with each child. For those parents who have one or two children, private time may be relatively easy. For those parents that have 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 children, how do you find private time every day? 2 minutes, 4 minutes, private time. So that if your son or daughter wants to ask you a question, they have that 3 minutes of private time every single day. My colleague Dina Shook at Ohel talks about doing homework, not only with your 4-year-old, but with your 16-year-old, and just helping them out. You know, we all laugh about the fact that, you know, now with new math and everything else that's going on, we have trouble doing homework with our 6-year-old. Imagine doing physics with your 16-year-old. So how do you help a 16-year-old get through high school? So they talk about that's how you spend time with them. I would just like to repeat, I recently heard from Rabbi Steinwurzel about the first adolescent at risk, Ishmael, Avraham Avinu's son. Rabbi Steinwurzel talks about the fact that Rabbi Wolbe talks about 2 periods of gestation. Animals, when animals are born, they immediately walk. They immediately walk. All animals immediately walk. Children don't. So children have a gestation period of 9 months in the womb, and then they have another gestation period, the second part of 1 year, that they're weaned by the mother. So the Arizal talks about a very complex issue. The Arizal talks on Parshas Lech Lecha about Ishmael and Yitzchak. That Ishmael, Pasuk in Lech Lecha, talks about Ishmael, that when the Malach came and told Ishmael's mother Hagar that she was going to give birth, he said that your son is going to grow into a great nation. But he also said, V'hu iyeh pera adam. V'hu iyeh pera adam. At 13 years old, Ishmael did not need his father, Avraham Avinu. By contrast, Yitzchak, who, according to the Arizal, did not need to be weaned, who was born walking, already understood at birth that he needed his father, Avraham Avinu. How do we get to a point where our children understand that they need us, that they need us as parents? So, prevention is about teaching children that they can rely on us, that they can ask questions, that they can learn from us, and conversely, we as a community don't stigmatize our kids. If one of our kids comes home looking a little bit differently, looking a little different with a ponytail, his clothing is different, he has a pierced earring, he has a pierced lip, he's no longer wearing a kippah, how do we respond? Do we immediately stigmatize him and throw him out? Do we immediately throw him out of the yeshiva? Do we throw him out of shul? Do we throw him out of the community? Or do we provide him an opportunity to succeed? Very often it's only a self-expression. Very often it's a phase that someone is going through. So how do we respond as a community? I would... I'd like to end with the following thought. When Yaakov Avinu met Yosef after 22 years, we learn that Yaakov Avinu davened. You haven't seen your son in 22 years. You might say, Yaakov, you look thin. You lost weight. You look older. I'm very impressed. You became Power's right-hand man. But Yaakov Avinu didn't say any of that. Yaakov Avinu davened. And what did he davened? He said Kriya Shema. He said the pasuk Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. He said Shema because Yaakov was able to see things that we can't see. And he saw in Yosef after 22 years the one most important thing that a parent yearns for. He saw that Yosef had good children and good grandchildren. So he thanked God. He thanked Hashem for giving him good children and good grandchildren. If you're a parent like Yaakov and you have children like Yosef and you believe in God like they do, well, you're in pretty good shape. But the rest of us don't have that ability. So the rest of us need to, on a daily basis, work and hope that our children will listen to us and our children will relate to us. And if we can find a way to talk to our children in a way that they can believe that we were once a teenager also and leave the rest in the hands of God, then hopefully we'll all be matzliach. And we would not need the services from Jax. But when we don't succeed, Jax is an address that we should be able to go to and rely on them for support. Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll take a few moments of questions. Okay.
Let's look at both sides. Let's look at it first from the administration standpoint, and let's look at it from the parents and the child standpoint. The administration standpoint is the following. I have a parent body. I have 100. I have 600 kids in the yeshiva. And the parents are sending their son, their daughter to my yeshiva because they want a certain standard which my yeshiva has. Now, if I have 5, 10, 20, 30 kids that don't follow that standard, what are the other 95% of the parents going to do? Are they going to be tolerant? Are they going to say, look, I have nothing against those kids. But I chose this yeshiva because you have a standard. So if you're, if you've got a dozen kids now that are going from a felt kippah to a kippah suga, from a large kippah, from a black hat to a non-black hat, that's not the yeshiva that I was sending my child to. So what is the principal say to that parent body that comprises 95%? He has an issue. Now, the other side, you've got 20 parents out of a student body of 500 or any percentage. 5% is a good percentage to work with. You say, look, let's be a little bit more tolerant. My kid is just going through a phase. Didn't you go through this phase? You know, so the kippah got smaller. So he doesn't wear a hat. He can't wear a hat. And he doesn't wear his tzitzit out. What's wrong with that? He's a little bit slower. Maybe he's got a learning problem. The one thing that we don't want to do is blame it on ADD or ADHD, because that's become just a little bit too convenient. It's a struggle. So some yeshivas have permitted these kind of conversations in yeshivas, where you have school-based prevention programs. Conversations like this in a yeshiva has enlightened the parent body. Some yeshivas, so that's one answer. Another answer is, some yeshivas will speak with the kid, and in whatever word you want to use, a contract, say, look, I'm tolerant, but this is not this yeshiva. So let's work on it. It used to be that you'd get expelled, but let's work on it. We have a situation where, you know, the principal will bring in a child. Let's talk about it. Let's figure out what's going on. Are there any other changes that I want to know about? And how can I get you back to this? You don't want to come back to this? I don't want to throw you out. What kind of deal can we make? So I think the answer is how to make the right-wing yeshivas more tolerant. I don't think it's a question of how to make them more tolerant. I think it's also understanding their position, that they have carved out a certain place for themselves. And I believe a school-based prevention forum and having professionals collaborate with yeshivas to become partners with the yeshiva are two answers that we've found work. I can tell you in some of the most right-wing yeshivas, terrible terminology, however you want to categorize that, we're at a situation today which is good, which is very good, that there are boys and girls in yeshivas with drug problems, alcohol problems, eating disorders, that 5 years ago would have been expelled like this. So what is good is these kind of forums, these kids have remained in yeshivas with contracts, that they have to see a professional, that they have to sign consent that the professional can disclose to the principal. And the principal says, as long as you remain in counseling and I hear about that you're doing well, we've got a deal. Don't worry about the parent body. I'll take care of the parent body. As long as I know that you're in counseling and I'm hearing good reports, you can stay in this yeshiva. So another way is to buddy up a yeshiva with a mental health professional who's available to them. Yes.
What we do is there's a movie that we take in the schools, and what it is, it's about a baseball game. And what happens is one of the kids go, and he's the pitcher. And the following week he goes back to play the same game with the same friends. And he wants to be the pitcher again, but it's somebody else's turn to be the pitcher. So he gets all upset. And when he goes home with the friend wants to play with him, only he doesn't want to play with him because he's sad because he wasn't the pitcher. So again, in this film, and it's all about educating our children, there's someone who was sick who was taking medicine for a cold in the house. So what they said was, here, take Mr. Furley's medicine. It makes him feel better. And then the two puppets start arguing and say, why you don't take medicine to make you feel better. So in the school system today, we're educating our children from an earlier age because there is a big problem with drugs. And it's something I want to bring in about the solution. Because I mentioned before that I am an addict alcoholic. Okay, and there's reasons sometimes why someone becomes an addict alcoholic and why our children are choosing to use drugs. And that's why I want to say a little about me, and you know, thank you because it was a great education. Okay, because a lot of times, and why I wanted to tell more about my story, and today I want you to know that I'm okay with sharing it, and it's only the reason why I'm okay with it is because I'm 10 years clean and sober, and I've done a lot of work. Something happened to me when I was 10 years old. I started being sexually abused by a next-door neighbor. I had a father who had multiple sclerosis, and my abuser told me that if I said anything to my family, that my father would die. And at 10 years old, I believed him. So at 13, someone gave me my first drink. And when I took a drink, all of a sudden I felt like all the other kids. And that's how I had to live my life. So yes, with alcohol, I needed it. I needed it to survive. I needed to shut down from the neck down because I couldn't allow myself to feel my feelings because it was too painful. And I attracted the people who were like me. If you did drugs and you drank, you were my friend. If you didn't, I didn't want to have anything to do with you. I was brought up in a great family, and I can only say amazing things. My mother and father never did anything wrong. They were very open. They discussed everything. But I had to keep this secret because I really believed this person. After years and years, I attracted who I was, and I married someone who was right out of the yeshiva. Together, we brought 3 children into the world, and together we used. And I used, and I switched from alcohol, because alcohol, liquor stores, it should be okay to drink. They're on every corner. If you weren't allowed to drink, why would the LCBO be open in the evening? So I went from alcohol to drugs to cocaine to ending a marriage, walking away, blaming my husband that he was the problem, and if I got rid of him, everything would be okay. I went to Jewish Family and Child Services. I started to say there was something wrong with me. Today I'm grateful for Jax because what Jax gave me was the ability to get back into my body and to feel my feelings and to say, yes, this may have happened to me, but today it taught me to live in today and to live in the now. And from Jax brought me back to Judaism. And we were talking about things. We just had Rosh Hashanah at Jax. We had 72 Jewish people come for Rosh Hashanah, and some of these people never had Rosh Hashanah before. Because of the path they went down, their families separated. Jax brought their families back together. This year, Jax, we had a sukkah. We built a sukkah outside. There were people who came to us who cried, who have never, ever been in a sukkah. And they sat there with someone telling the story of why we have it. And it's funny the way Hanukkah comes out this year, because on December the 25th, we're having Hanukkah at Jax. And at 6:30 again, all these Jewish people are going to come into Jax, and we're going to tell each and every one of these Jewish people who walk through the doors about the miracle of Hanukkah and how each and every one of them are miracles. And I'm a miracle because I'm alive today. I want you to know I went to treatment and I was with 12 other people. I am the only one today who is clean and sober to be standing here to tell you the story. I will tell you, a year ago from Rosh Hashanah, I lost my best friend, 37 years old, to alcoholic poisoning, who left 2 children. These are the things we're dealing with. What Gordon Hayward shared, this is a life and death disease. But the chances are when you come to Jax, we're here to help the family. We're here to help anybody. And there is a chance. And there is a bright light. Because I'm an example, and so is Jay, and so is the person that you spoke about who sat behind the curtain with his mother, telling his story, and that there's great people like David to go around and say, you know what, we're Jewish people, but we're affected just like anybody else. So I want to thank you too for coming out and speaking also, and on behalf of Jax. And at the same time of thanking you, just if anyone has any questions after Jax, we have an executive committee and they're here. Neville, John, Al, Jack, Faye, can you just raise your hand in case anybody wants to ask any questions. Please grab one of these people. Don't go home, because today there is help, and we need to talk about it. And if you need me to come into your school or into your synagogue or anything, I go around and I speak everywhere, and I take kids speaking to kids. So thanks, everybody, for coming this evening.
Okay, thank you very much. I really don't have anything else I can say. It's really a very powerful evening, and I invite you to have cake and cookies and have a good night. And let's hope this is a beginning to constructively deal with a serious issue in our community. Thank you. Have a good night.